Welcome to Threshold Stories, crossing thresholds one story at a time. I'm your host, Jeff Gora.
Podcast 103, behind the scenes in my second book. So in order for me to jump to a behind-the-scenes story, I probably have to give you a reason to keep listening. So the last part of this podcast is going to be where I answer questions on Goodreads that people have asked me. So it'll be more than what you see on Goodreads with a lot more content. I hope you find that interesting because I'll very much do some disclosure of heart and soul there. To start with, though, book two requires a wee bit of book one, and not a lot, but a wee bit. So at the start of my core desire to write is a personality. I don't know if it's a defect or a trait that I have, where I love unwinded myths. So I love finding something that I thought was true that's not. I love finding something that you thought was true that was not. And I'm going to tell you my most recent discovery of that. So we have two foreign exchange students living with us. One's from the Canary Islands, a Spanish kid. And we typically have long European-style dinners now at the house where everybody sits down for an hour and we talk well beyond the course of eating the food. And it's just a catch-up time and everybody likes it. So early on in our conversation, Christopher Columbus came up in the conversation as we were sharing some history stuff. And the kid from the Canary Islands said, "Who?" And we gave him his name and he asked again who, and we spit out his history so he could finally identify. He says, "Oh, you mean Cristobal Colon?" And I thought, "Cristobal Colon? What are you talking about?" And then he shared with us, yeah, he spent a lot of time in the Canaries. We have a museum about him. Look it up. His name isn't Columbus. So I thought, And so I did. I looked it up. So his dad's name is Domingo Colon. And he had two children, Diego and Hernando, and their each last names are Colon. So how did his name get to be Columbus if his dad's Colon and his children is Colon? Well, it's because we gave it to him. That wasn't the name that was given to him. It was one we gave to him. And so that's kind of a great example of unwinding of a myth. And since I've had that discovery in the last month, I've had a couple of other chances to tell others, and I love watching their response, and I love watching them say, "Okay, I'm going to go check it out." And then they come back and check it out and say, "Son of a gun, I didn't know that." So one of the larger myths that I use to construct the tale behind book number one is this idea that when Jesus died, all the prophecy was fulfilled and the world began matriculating from Christianity, starting with 12 disciples all the way up to the 1.7 million there were today, and that everything we needed to see come to pass to convince the world that Jesus was God was complete. Well, that's not true. Matthew 24, Mark 13, Luke 21, they all make reference to the need for a temple to be destroyed. And a lot of the hardcore Pharisees at the time, even the ones perhaps who had seen Jesus, had not yet been convinced because there was prophecy that had not yet been filled. And granted, a lot of that prophecy was New Testament prophecy. It was still prophecy. And it didn't happen until 70 AD by some measure, 60 AD by another measure, that the temple actually fell. So if I do a math problem, right, when did the temple fall and when did Jesus die? You see a gap in the middle there of close to 40 years, since 30 years and change. That's intuitive to me that it took a little while. Keep in mind that when Jesus was walking the earth, he only occupied a small little smidgen of transposed dirt that he walked on. But people heard him, or they heard of him for the most part during his ministry time when he walked around. He demanded attention. But most people never heard him, and most people never heard of him. That's a data point of grand significance. Most everybody in Rome didn't know him. People in Egypt, of course, didn't hear him. Britannia, you know, lots of places there was no Jesus stepping on soil and sharing. They only got third party at best. Transportation back then wasn't what it was today. There was no internet. There was no cell phone calls. So everything was word of mouth for the most part. Very little was written, especially compared to today. So the idea that God created an entire generational gap between when he died and when the temple fell gave a chance for a whole new generation of seekers to see for themselves that Jesus is alive and well and the prophecies he gave are real and they come true. So all the characters in the first book had no experience with Christ, no experience, very little, if any, stories of Christ. But they knew enough about the prophecy, and they knew enough about the Torah and the idea that there were disciples that had come after Christ, that when the temple fell, that was a moment when they went, huh, that's pretty significant. So I built that, the secret really in the book, one of the secrets in the book has to do with that. I'm unwinding that specific myth about the Christian faith. I introduced two characters in that book who were both New Testament characters for which we have a story, but the story was incomplete. We only get the portions in there that God wanted us to, who felt like we needed to know. So I expand fictionally upon two of those characters and grow their lives and their persona, and I grow the impact they had on earth outside of the scope of the story that they're part of. And that one of those characters trickles all the way through throughout the entire trilogy. So you'll hear from him throughout the entire trilogy. So building upon that, when book one is complete, I fast forward to book two. Now, this is where I'm stuck having to work within the confines of history. The man who led the assault to destroy Jerusalem in 68 AD didn't become emperor until something like 12 on one measurement, 14 years later on another. So I had to wait some time for him to become emperor in order to continue my tale. And one of the main assumptions I built that on is that once you're family, you're always family. And distant family and close family, that you're still family. So the characters in book two are related to the characters in book one, but none of them knew the Emperor of Rome, even though third hand he was, you know, indirectly connected to them through relationship. Well, they have an event in their life that I can't tell you about. It'd be a spoiler alert. And they don't have a plan B to fix it that works for them other than to attempt to go visit their distant uncle, Titus, and attempt to get his assistance with the whole process. It's filled with action and adventure, partly because it was requested, but partly because it's very interesting to write something that's action-based that includes travel, because that's my personality as well. Like all adventure, though, they are damaged as they attach themselves to the joy and the act of discovery. So therein lies another assumption I make. The act of discovering things new without any sense of protection about what's about to happen to you inevitably causes some sort of damage. Now, I'm not talking physical damage. I'm just causing emotional damage from things that you see, things that you hear, not just something that's offensive, but something that penetrates your soul and it can disgust you in the process. So without another spoiler alert, book three is coming out and it's going to address those specific needs. So book two takes place after the fall of the temple and Titus has become emperor in Rome. And the characters in the second book get to explore what that means, what it means to be in the Roman Empire, what the Roman Empire looks like as you traverse the different lands that the Roman Empire has taken over, and how really crazy things were back then. So for book two Q&A follow-up, I think the right answer to do is to answer some questions from Goodreads. So where did I get my ideas for my most recent book in the trilogy? Well, I think I'm pretty normal in that sense. I have unresolved conflicts in my life. I have broken relationships I wish I could go back and fix. I have regrets from actions that I've taken. Yes, I've taken them to the Lord. I've taken them to counsel, but I still have myself yearning for things that I can't fix anymore. After all, I'm made in God's image, right? And the desire for relationship never goes away. And so all these characters have roots in unresolved or conflict in my life that I'm just not going to be able to fix. How do you deal with writer's block? I got that question from somebody. And I said, by far for me, the most effective strategy is to take out my road bicycle, not my racing bicycle, and drive to a parking lot in a grocery store that's right on the edge of a whole lot of nothing, a very big section of undeveloped road. The roads are paved, but very few people live out there, so it's a safe place to ride. I'd get my heart rate up to 150 and I leave it there for 2 hours. And I just cycle 40, 42 miles through some hilly terrain. And I just blast through my body's glycogen store and get my mind starts getting super clean when I do that. And whatever writer's block I had when I do that is gone. For me, the interim step is I just need to go out and burn 2,000 calories. I'm not going to suggest that that's the way to go for everybody, but because of my athletic tint, a really hard workout does me wonders. And I know I'm not unique like that, but I don't think I'm the standard either. What's the best thing about being a writer? For most of us who've written several books, the answer changes with both experience and age. For my first book, the answer was related to just accomplishing the task of taking a fictional tale that had bounced around in your head of some length and then putting it into a published work. For the last book in the series, it was all about how can I take courageous decisions and turn those into moments of healing? How can I take the task of overcoming something that's really adverse and making myself and others around me better for it? Another question, if you could travel to any place in the world, where would you go and what would you do there? So there's two real answers there. I'll do the harder one first. I think I would prefer to be one of Adam's great-great-grandchildren, one of Adam and Eve's great-great-grandchildren living a long time ago. I feel the because the earth would be relatively uninhabited and it'd be basically raw earth, the chance to explore would be literally at an all-time high. Because our lifespans are very long, I would get a lot of exploration in because I'd be living several hundred years, or at least we're led to believe that. And I think it'd be wonderful to be able to go back to my great-great-grandfather and great-great-grandmother and say, so this is what I saw today. What was it like in its original form? Here's the fish I saw, or here's the animal I saw. What did it look like originally? Now, granted, I wouldn't have the ability to have a cell phone to take a picture to show them what it was I'm talking about, but I'd have to describe it. And we don't really have any insight as to what language was being used back then. So I wouldn't know if I have 2,000 words to work with or 20,000 words to work with. But I think it'd be wonderful to be taking my discoveries back to people who lived through Eden and hearing them to say, well, back in the day when God walked with me in the garden, it used to look like this. I think that'd be wonderful. The second choice I think I'd want, and it's for identical reasons, because I'm strong and I'm fit and I like to explore and I'm a leader, is probably go back into Tolkien's Middle Earth. I like the idea that he built up that every race has conflict within each race, and then every race has conflicts with other race. That's the theme that goes, you know, throughout all of his writings, the elves, the dwarves, the humans. And that's kind of deep because, you know, we all have conflicts both within our family, on the roads we live on, in the communities we're in, and within our own nations. I think that would be super fantastic to explore. Another question here. What advice do you have for aspiring writers? So I didn't get this advice, and I wish I'd gotten it, because all I knew was I wanted to write a book one day, because it was on my bucket list of, you know, 103 things I wanted to do before I died. And I'd started it, and I had a folder that I kept everything in on my computer called Book One. I didn't even have a name for it. And I had an outline and then a couple of attempts to write a book. Well, when I finally got around to writing the story and I went and looked at that folder and saw what I had to start with, it was kind of demoralizing. The outline sucked. The quantity of work that I had typed, I could have recreated in about 10 minutes knowing what I know today. And I realized that I probably shouldn't have jumped in as an author who doesn't have much experience, who was told by his eighth grade English teacher that he's never going to be able to write very well. I probably should have started with a short story. I shouldn't have started with the concept of a three-book trilogy. And as part of that writing of a short story, I should have started by committing to writing a single page. So I say I'm going to write a short story, but today's a single page, because short stories are typically, you know, single digit to double digit number of pages and you're done. And then I would have had something that would have prompted me to say on that single page, first write a paragraph. And as the act of creating a paragraph starts with a single word. So start with that single word and then ruminate on it. And then don't be shocked at what kind of outcome happens with a single word. If you just walk into a bookstore or just do some samples on Amazon Kindle, just read the first sentence of a couple of different books. you will see that what I just described is a pretty commonplace strategy. Start with a single sentence and see what you can make of it. Sometimes those single sentences create a discrepant event for the author, something that doesn't make sense. Kind of like when you drop a metal ball on one side of a series of five balls and the metal ball on the other side comes out instead of the whole thing moving. The concept of conservation momentum. You can't expect that. You wouldn't predict that. That was a discrepant event. That's pretty interesting stuff. Start with that as a starting point on writing, and I think you'll enjoy what comes from it. What's on your summer reading list? Sarah B. gave me the book Not Forsaken by Louis Giglio. And I've only started on that a couple of days ago. I'm certainly not done yet, but every time I read a chapter, it makes me pause and think. I do not script out the books I read. I basically am a reactionary reader, and I'm a card-holding member of the One Book at a Time Club, so I don't have several books going at once. So I'm a one book at a time kind of guy. Now, all that said, I'm going to have a couple more podcasts that I'm going to produce in October. One's going to be about book three. I'm also going to talk about the long distance national championship that I competed in this last weekend and give you some insights about that. And I'll be including some video I shot of some of the other people who are participating in that, who are also believers in Christ. And I hope you find that interesting. Stay tuned, guys. More to come.
Thanks for listening to this chapter of Threshold Stories, Crossing Thresholds, One Story at a Time. Ready to cross more thresholds with me in 2 weeks. If you have any questions, feel free to reach out to me directly. You can find me on LinkedIn or on my Facebook page at Jeff Gora Team USA.